Well, there's just so much. It's nice to have a debate where people have so much time to speak from the floor, I think, isn't it? Because I've been to a lot of debates when, like, it's two speakers and then you've got 5 minutes and then that's it, and you feel frustrated you didn't get to put your point across. I'm just going to do my level best to just address everyone, and I won't restate my own case. Daniel, your point's about either system, they've both been propounded and proposed, but why haven't they worked yet? Quite a few of you guys have said, look, I do hold my hand up. I was trying to avoid the straw man thing with Stalin. I've kind of failed, didn't I? So, and also, I'll talk about the ad hominem thing in a minute, but it's difficult for me because I haven't seen a working model of Marxism, I suppose, apart from maybe Castro's Cuba. But why has it worked yet? And what about Christianity? That doesn't seem to work, does it, with all the corruption in the churches? Look at the problems that the Roman Catholic Church has had over the last few years and everything like that. I think the thing is that you have to look... You have to compare the claims with the reality, and what Jesus Christ has claimed was never to create a group of perfect people. And there's one Christian teacher that says, you know, perfect man, and on the back it says under construction. So the point being that as a Christian, I'm a massively flawed individual. In fact, that's the first thing you have to recognise when you become a Christian, is that you're a massively flawed individual, and that you need something outside of yourself to change you and to save you. And I'm a perfect man under construction. So obviously a church is a group of people that are filled with problems and sins in their lives, and as one archbishop put it, the church is the only organisation that exists for the benefit of its non-members. So we go out and we try and reach other beggars. We consider ourselves to be beggars that have found bread, the bread of life in Jesus Christ. So I do think that we're not looking to create a perfect world system. We do believe that this world will be destroyed and there will be a new heavens and a new earth where righteousness dwells. Generally, quite a lot of people have said, does that mean, I think Rachel was saying that we can just sort of sit there and do nothing, and we're just pietistic and individualistic, and we don't try and change society? Well, if you look at, you know, social history, Christians have been at the forefront of changing society. Think about Wilberforce, who from his deathbed heard that the Houses of Parliament had passed into law the abolition of slavery. He was a very evangelical Christian, active advocate. Marx himself talks about the 10 hours laws that were passed during his lifetime in England, which limited the amount of hours that children and women had to work 10 hours a day. And that was put forward by three Christians. I think it was a Presbyterian, a Methodist and a Quaker. So it's always been, since, you know, certainly up until the 19th century, Christians that have been at the forefront of social change. Because, not because we think this life is the be-all and end-all, yes, we do think it's a prelude, but that doesn't reduce its importance. In fact, it increases importance because we see the image of God in every man and woman. And unlike some kind of protagonists of Marxism, we don't see people as useless eaters. We see people as absolutely significant in their own right, including babies. So that's why Christians are at the forefront of the pro-life movement as well, which probably most Marxists would disagree with, because you don't see that human beings have an essential value. You see us as being products of material things. So that's why I want to say that we, you know, if Christians are failing to do their duty in modern society, then they're failing to live up to the standard of Christ. Daniel, you also said about the kind of lottery idea of, you know, it's sort of bad luck that you have someone like Stalin in charge. But what I was trying to say to you is that absolute power corrupts absolutely. That there's something flawed within the Marxist system, that although it's supposed to give democracy, as Nicholas was saying, to the entire world, you know, so we can all vote over the internet about everything that gets decided, in reality, power does get concentrated in the hands of a few people. When you have a command economy, a planned economy, and it's not driven by market forces, that I hold no brief for, by the way, but I do think a planned and a command economy is worse, because inevitably you do get the pigs taking over the farm. You do. And I think you guys, you Marxists, you always underestimate the power of human greed. I mean, you talk about, you know, if we all had enough stuff, we'd all be happy and we wouldn't be fighting. And that the only reason why we have conflict is because we have a scarcity. What is the concept of hoarding to you? Do you not see that people hoard stuff all the time? And that people and kids squabble over it? They might have like 10 trucks and there's a little kid that's got one and they'll want that truck as well. You know, what about philanderers? There are such people, even at university, even at UCL, dare I say, who have sex with 10 women and then they want someone else's girlfriend as well. You know, there's something inherently greedy about us, that nothing is enough in for us until our nature is changed by Jesus Christ. And that's why we do need him. And we can't solve our problems because we are the problem. There's just so many issues here. I mean, I wish I could have more time to cover them. Let me just sort of talk about the ad hominem thing, because I think that was a reasonable criticism that was made by Gavin and other people, that I was basically making it all about Marx's kind of slightly dissolute lifestyle. I did hear that he went on a pub crawl up Tottenham Court Road, actually, and he went to 18 different pubs, and then him and Engels went around smashing streetlights, and they were chased around the road by the police. I got all this stuff from Mark Steele lectures, okay? And Mark Steele was a member of the Socialist Worker Party, all right? So this isn't me banging any kind of, like, reactionary drum to sort of pour scorn on Marx. But the point is, the reason why I mentioned Marx's lifestyle is because of what I'm trying to illustrate here. It's not purely ad hominem attacks, but there's something in his philosophy that can't essentially make him a better person. That there's something flawed in it, because at the end of the day, it doesn't lead to a greater Marx. And if Marxism doesn't lead to a better Marx, then how can Marxism lead to a better society for the rest of us? That's my kind of argument there. Marx himself did actually say in the Communist Manifesto, quoting his philosophy, not his life, okay, he says that the communists would introduce a community of women. In other words, having every woman in common. So you just take your pick, you know. That's what it says. What am I doing?
Read the whole
thing. Referencing.
Yes. Yeah. But what he says is the communists have no need to introduce a community of women. It has existed from time immemorial. Right? So he's criticizing the bourgeois, right? And he's saying the bourgeois, you will take prostitutes. But he's not saying I'm going to change that. He's talking about a community. Okay. All right, well, I've misread it then, but it seems to me that he doesn't... Okay, so in which case, he was really sorry about impregnating Helen. Is that what I'm saying? I'm misunderstanding it, and forgive me if I misunderstand it. All right. I've kind of aroused disgust in these people here. So what you're saying is, communism does not propose a community of women, and that you do believe in marriage, because we've had comments made about the bourgeois family unit, haven't we? And we've talked about early primitive forms of communism, where everything was held in common. If you guys are coming out here and now and you're talking about marital fidelity for life between one man and one woman, then I'm with you. But I'm not sure you're saying that, are you? But maybe you can clarify that. Guy called Will was talking about... actually, one guy that I really want to look at, because he asked a load of questions about the Bible. I really, very quickly, want to address them, because I just feel that there were quite a few sort of basic factual errors in them, although they were really interesting questions. It was Ben. Where's Ben? Who's Ben?
Yeah.
Yeah. You said that... Jesus lived the perfect life, but he ran away from his mum. Okay, I just wanted to address that, because in actual fact, he didn't run away from his mum. His mum and his dad, they went to Jerusalem along with Jesus, and Jesus stayed behind. And Joseph and Mary, assuming that he was with the other kids, went back home. And then they found out he wasn't, and they went back to look for him. In actual fact, there's no criticism in the Bible for what Jesus was doing. And it was an important stage in Jesus' life, because he was 12, which is the age of majority in Judaism. And he said to them, "Did you not know that I'd be about the business of my father?" So it's an important point for Joseph and Mary when they had to realise that Jesus actually didn't belong to them, he belonged to God. He said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Not my Father, why have you forsaken me? And in doing that on the cross, he was quoting one of the Psalms and so fulfilling a prophecy. He wasn't defying God or disobeying his parents. When he turned water into wine, that's totally fine. Christians are fine with alcohol. Some of you might come to the pub afterwards, I don't know. If people are still talking to me, my terrible misquotations of the Communist Manifesto, maybe no one will get me a point, I don't know. But Jesus doesn't obviously encourage alcoholism. The Bible says, do not be drunk on wine, instead be filled with the Holy Spirit. But there's nothing wrong with alcohol. In the Garden of Gethsemane, I did try and make this point, Ben, but maybe I just didn't make it clearly enough. Quite the opposite of what you said. He absolutely did not incite his followers to armed rebellion. In fact, when the guys came to arrest him, he said, "Why are you coming out with all these weapons as if I was an insurrectionist?" And when Peter sliced off the ear of Malchus, the high priest's slave, he said to Peter, "Don't do that. Put up your sword, because if you live by the sword, you die by the sword." Jesus said that. That quotation, "live by the sword, die by the sword," comes from Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. And then he went on to face trial, and he said nothing, he didn't fight, he didn't blink, he was whipped, he was beaten, and he was crucified. He did nothing to defend himself, because he was basically a pacifist. The point I think someone else was making was, what about this contradiction between turning the other cheek and fighting in battle, and Christians like Abraham Lincoln fighting for slavery? There is a distinction within the Bible between individual responses to offences. So if you guys, any of you sort of swear at me or nick something of mine, or I do that to you, then I am under obligation to forgive you. But in terms of the state, the Bible does teach that the state, as was said by, I think, Anna, was it? Is it Anna? Yeah, earlier on, that the state has an obligation to exercise righteousness and justice and to fight for the oppressed. So I think it's not a contradiction for a state to go to war on behalf of, for example, the Second World War. The Christians should theoretically have no problem whatsoever in going to fight in the Second World War. If a German person comes and steals my pint, I have to forgive him. But if I'm in a war against a Nazi and I'm in a trench, then I have to fight, because I'm fighting on behalf of the state for vulnerable people. I do think the Garden of Eden is a fact. I think evolution is a fairy tale for grown-ups, and I've got to finish. let me just make, I guess, one more final point, which is, you know, it's really fun to talk about all this stuff, and I do think that it's important, and I'm really glad that we live in a free society. There have been many societies in history where these kind of meetings, even today, would not be allowed to happen. And I'm really grateful to God and to Josh. at least one of those people is real.
Who is not God?
On the same level, yeah. For this opportunity, this and for Fred as well. And I'm looking forward to hear what Fred's got to say. But I think that, you know, we have to use our freedoms wisely, and we have to take advantage of this time that you've got in your life as students, some of you a bit older like me, to figure this stuff out. Please read the Bible. Please read the Communist Manifesto. I'm talking to Josh about reading Das Kapital, which is probably as brave as trying to read the Bible. They're both sort of 800 pages plus. But, you know, investigate these things and see whether there is real substantial reasons to believe. Evidence is not contrary to faith. That's a misconception, because faith is the evidence of things unseen. Now, we believe because we've heard. And what we've heard, we believe, we put trust in it because of the witnesses. We believe them to be reliable. We've read their testimonies, we've read the Gospels, and we've understood that they lived and died claiming that Christ is risen from the dead, and we believe them. Now, we could be naive, we could be wrong, but we believe it based on the evidence. Okay, and we have faith in what we do not see, but we do believe it because we've heard it. We don't have blind faith. We have faith in what we hear. And I do encourage you to hear and to listen and to read and to investigate. Jesus Christ, the man who stands above all others in history, and he is the way forward for humanity. Thanks.